Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
What we learned investigating the death of Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez.
It sounds like you ran almost every theory to its end.
Binge all 8 episodes of Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Libby Dankman in for Larry Mantle. California is taking steps to try to fix the shameful inequalities we're seeing in COVID-19 vaccine distribution across the state. A new analysis shows the extreme disparity in COVID deaths between Latino and Black Angelenos versus people who are white or Asian. In our continuing series, looking at the latest medical research and news on COVID-19, Kristen R. Choi joins me, professor of nursing and public health at UCLA. She's a registered nurse practicing at Gateways Hospital, which is based in Echo Park. Welcome, Kristen. Thank you so much for being on Air Talk.
Hi, Libby. Thank you for having me.
First of all, we are hearing from the state of California that they are trying to address really this shameful disparities between neighborhoods that we see with predominantly Black and brown people and more poverty and more wealthy areas and vaccination rates. This is compounded by the fact that these poorer areas generally have higher case rates and the white areas and richer areas have much lower case rates. First of all, what's your assessment of how things got so bad on the disparity scale when it comes to vaccine distribution?
Sure. So I think when we think about vaccine distribution, the rollout has been fairly complicated in California and certainly in Los Angeles, where we have a really large population and a lot of communities, as you said, that have been hit disproportionately by COVID. A lot of the rollout, there have been some frustrations and challenges with signups. And the megapods where vaccines are being distributed in LA that are primarily drive-up sites and require you to have a computer appointment prior to coming in mean that there are a lot of barriers to access for some communities. If you don't have a car, if you don't speak English, if you maybe have trouble using computers or technology, it's going to make it much harder for you to get an appointment. Beyond that, what I've heard from a lot of patients at the vaccination sites where I've been giving COVID vaccines is that in some cases, people spent days and hours or had, you know, their whole families just refreshing the sites waiting for an appointment. A lot of people don't have the luxury of that time to really put into trying to get an appointment with a system that's so challenged. So I think that all of those things are part of the issue. I think another factor that we have to consider is that there is a lot of medical mistrust for very good reason in some of these communities. There's a long history of inequality and disparities in healthcare access and qualities among Black and Hispanic communities. And I think people, again, with good reason in some cases, don't necessarily trust the medical establishment or the county to have their best interest in mind. All those things have kind of created the situation we're in now. But the good news is that the state has just announced that, you know, we're going to be allocating more vaccines to areas that were harder hit. And I really hope that we are going to start moving in a new direction in terms of addressing these disparities.
I'm talking with Kristen R. Choi, professor of nursing and public health at UCLA. She's a registered nurse and she practices at Gateways Hospital based in Echo Park. And I want to note that you are a child and adolescent psychiatric nurse. And if folks out there, in addition to their regular COVID questions, which we take every day here on Air Talk and try to get a medical expert to help guide people through what's going on in the pandemic, you can also take questions specified towards children's health and mental health and adolescent mental health, which I think is such a huge deal right now with COVID-19 and the way that it's upended everything. So give us a call if you are listening and you have any questions related to COVID or specifically adolescent and child health, 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722 to weigh in with your questions. You can also tweet us or email us. You can go on our Facebook page to ask a question, or we have our show page at kpcc.org where you can comment with a question. And you have been giving vaccine shots as a nurse yourself. Is there anything that, from the provider's standpoint, you would like people to know about the experience of getting and giving the vaccine, and particularly, you know, between the first and second dose?
Sure, absolutely. So I think the first thing I'd tell people is to be patient with the process. I think the number one concern that we're seeing is that right now demand greatly exceeds supply. And I know there's a lot of frustration about there about people not being able to get appointment or get a vaccine. So I first want to just tell people to be patient. Supply is scaling up more and more every day, and we are looking like we're going to be in a really good place to have vaccines available to just about everyone here this spring and summer. I would also say to people, one of the biggest questions that I get about the vaccines is about side effects and kind of what to expect from the vaccines. We do know that these vaccines have fairly high rates of side effects, although most of them are pretty transient. And so I've been telling people just to kind of look out for things like fatigue, headache, muscle pain, fever. Those are kind of the most common ones we're seeing. And also to know that those side effects are more common after the second dose in the case of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Interestingly, we also know that side effects are actually worse for people who are younger. A bit counterintuitive, but people who are younger getting these vaccines have a stronger immune system and more capacity to respond. And so we do also see slightly higher rates of side effects for people who are under the age of 55. So I think just knowing what to expect can be really helpful. The other thing I'd say is, you know, to take a look at how the vaccines work. A lot of people have questions and are coming in thinking that the vaccines do something to maybe alter DNA. It's a really common misconception I'm seeing, even among people that are there about to get their shot. But these vaccines, the ones we're currently giving, Pfizer and Moderna, are actually RNA vaccines, and they never interact with the DNA of your cells in any way. So those are some of the big issues that I'm seeing. And of course, if folks have questions about the vaccines, it's always good to ask. Even if you're at the point of just being about to get it, I have a lot of these conversations with people right there on the spot.
I think it's fascinating to know that younger people have a stronger reaction generally. I had not heard that before, but it makes sense with the immune system reaction.
Yes.
If folks are not getting a strong reaction from that second Moderna or Pfizer vaccine, should they be concerned at all that maybe they're a non-reactive patient?
That's a great question, Libby. No, they don't need to be concerned about that. The data from the studies of both Pfizer and Moderna, as well as Johnson & Johnson, which is just coming out very recently here, suggests that there's very good immune response and the vaccines are very effective and safe, even if you don't have the side effects. Our bodies, you know, just all react differently, and so some people do have those side effects, most people actually. But if you don't, it definitely doesn't mean that the vaccine didn't work or that you're not protected. We can still be pretty confident from what the data are showing right now that the vaccines work very well.
That's Professor Kristen Choi, Professor of Nursing and Public Health at UCLA. She's also a registered nurse that practices at Gateways Hospital based in Echo Park. We're taking your calls on COVID-19 and anything you want to know in terms of your health during this pandemic. 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. And Kathy in Northridge is on the line. Hi, Kathy in Northridge. You have a question when it comes to kids and going back to school.
Yes. So there are children who have underlying health conditions. So what's... should they be going back to school? And if the recommendation is that they don't go back to school, how should parents handle that conversation when they see their schools are opening and their friends are going back to school as far as, like, you know, the social emotional part?
Great question, Kathy. Professor Choi, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kathy, and a big concern. We know that a lot of kids have underlying health concerns, things like asthma, type 1 diabetes, et cetera, that might put them at higher risk for COVID or complications of COVID. In those cases, you know, I think that a lot of the schools are talking about some kind of hybrid model when they first go back. I think a hybrid model will be a really good way for us to transition as we're still waiting for vaccinations to come out and cases to come down. And also, you know, we know a lot more about the virus and how we can take steps to protect ourselves. And those would be things like wearing masks, hand washing, spacing desks, opening windows when possible. All of those things we can implement to potentially make schools safer and reduce the risk of COVID spreading among kids there at school. However, I think you're absolutely right that there are some kids for whom it may not be safe, or parents may not feel comfortable having them be even in a hybrid environment or an environment with protections. And in those cases, I think it's really important to tell kids that, you know, this is temporary. We don't expect that we will be in this situation forever. And even if you're not going back to school right away or with the same frequency that other schools or other kids might be, I think just reassuring kids that they will get there eventually and we will be back to normal soon. I think beyond that, you know, I'm seeing a lot of kids and teens in my practice as a nurse who are really, really dealing with the stress of isolation and loneliness and just really having a hard time because they are so isolated from their friends. We know that socialization and friends are very important to child development. And so if you do have kids who are at home to some degree for school going forward, I think it's also really important to think about ways that we can connect them to friends, to family, and that they can feel connected to their peers in ways that are safe, whether that's through Zoom or technology, through social media. I think there's a lot of ways to do it. But those connections are really important, even for kids who might be attending hybrid school or still doing online learning.
Kristen Choi, professor of nursing and public health at UCLA. And thanks, Kathy in Northridge, for that great question. If you have any questions, especially when it comes to kids and going back to school, or kids and psychology, adolescents and psychology during the pandemic, give us a call, 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. And Professor Choi is also here to answer your other questions about COVID-19. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle. Back with more after this. Hi there, Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Today on Air Talk, Kristen Choi, professor of nursing and public health at UCLA, is with me answering your COVID questions. And one came in from John in Pasadena asking if vaccines cause blood clots as a side effect, because his father got a blood clot after getting the vaccine, one of the vaccines. Unfortunately, I don't know if it was Moderna or Pfizer. And John specifies that his father is on blood thinners. Anything you know about the relationship between the vaccine and blood clots, Professor Choi?
Sure. So from the studies of the two mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer and Moderna, blood clots were not something that came up as a common side effect of the vaccines. That being said, I think it's really important to know that the side effects that we found in the studies versus what we're finding when vaccines are now being given to millions of people are different. There's a lot of differences between people who are in the studies and the whole population of people getting them. Lots of people have more medical conditions and special circumstances that might not have been included in the studies. And we also know that sometimes the timing of a vaccine can coincide with other health events just by chance. There have been all kinds of reports of sort of isolated and rare cases like this of some other reactions that didn't come up in the studies. And I would say that for anyone who has an underlying health condition, concerns about medications or things like that that apply in terms of getting the vaccine, it's a good idea to talk with your personal health care provider and think about the risks and trade-offs of getting the vaccine with those conditions. Unfortunately, we don't have really great widespread data yet because these vaccines are so new about what they look like for all kinds of different people with various health conditions, as well as some of these rare adverse events that can happen. And we will have more information about that in the future as we keep getting them out. But at this time, data is fairly limited, so I would definitely encourage anyone with a concern to talk to their personal health care provider.
And this is another question about side effects. Sarah from Santa Monica, who also sent me a very nice email, asked, after she had both of her Moderna shots, after the second shot, she noticed that really chronic arthritis in her hips had diminished. It seems like a positive side effect, according to Sarah. And she realizes that this is maybe far-fetched, but it seems to be happening at the same time. And she wonders if there's some type of correlation between a second vaccine, a Moderna vaccine, and the subsiding of her arthritis symptoms.
Interesting. You know, that's a really good question, Sarah. And to that, I would say kind of the same thing I said earlier. There's a lot of questions out there about, you know, how these vaccines will affect different groups of people with different disorders like arthritis. Unfortunately, you know, we can't quite derive conclusions yet. And kind of the isolated cases like these make it hard to know what's going on at a really large scale. But again, you know, as we keep getting them out and collecting data, we will learn more and more. Definitely would encourage Sarah and anyone else getting the vaccine to report your symptoms through the CDC's tracking system, and that'll help us learn more about these vaccines going forward.
Really interesting question coming in from Kindley in Long Beach. Kindley, what's your question?
Hi, yes, thank you. I actually had COVID-19 last spring in my second trimester of pregnancy. Since my son was born, and he's been very healthy as far as we can tell, he's 6 months old now. My question is, I'm wondering, what do we know about potential immunity or protection that infants or babies might have if they were exposed to the coronavirus in utero?
Isn't that an interesting one? Professor Choi, what do you know about that?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So in theory, we think that it's possible for the antibodies to be passed on to an infant or a fetus. That's potentially true from having COVID as well as from getting the vaccines. However, the major caveat I would give with that is that these things are, again, still being studied, and we don't have great data yet about what that looks like, and probably most importantly, if antibodies are passed on, how long they will last. So, you know, certainly we know that there are antibody tests out there that you could consider to see if there are antibodies, but there's still quite a lot we don't know about how long they last that I think we need to be cautious of when it comes to thinking about pregnancy. The CDC does also have a pregnancy registry for registering people who get the COVID vaccine while they're pregnant, and so we also know that Pfizer is now doing a study of the vaccine with pregnant women. Expect that we will learn much more about this population going forward, how COVID as well as the vaccines affect pregnant women and infants.
Kindley, thank you very much for your call and great question. And Professor Choi, just following up on the issue of infants, is there a timeline or any plans on expanding vaccines for kids? Is there enough study of that?
Yeah, you know, thinking about vaccinations for kids is a really, really big issue. You know, kids are about a quarter of our population in the U.S. And, you know, when we think about needing to get to 70, 80, 90% of people immunized to have herd immunity, it's absolutely going to be essential that kids are a part of the group that are getting vaccinated. At this time, the Pfizer vaccine is the only one that's approved for teenagers ages 16 and older. And right now, Pfizer and Moderna are testing their vaccines for younger teens as well as younger kids. I don't believe that they are at the stage yet of testing vaccines with infants or very young children, but it's possible that we may get there as we learn more and kind of work backwards from adults to see how they affect younger and younger populations. But certainly figuring out how these vaccines work for kids, if they're safe for kids, and if they offer protection is going to be a huge priority, especially as we move towards reopening schools.
You're listening to KPCC and Air Talk. Kristen Choi, professor of nursing and public health at UCLA, also a registered nurse who practices at Gateway's Hospital based in Echo Park. She's answering your questions about COVID-19, and especially because she specializes in child and adolescent psychiatry, you can talk to her about those issues when it comes to maybe fears about schools or the psychological impact of the pandemic. All those questions are welcome, plus your broader questions about the pandemic. 866-893-5722. We'll get back to more questions right after a very short break here. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle, today on Air Talk. Welcome back. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Libby Denkman here for Larry Mantle. Professor Kristen Choi with UCLA is also here, and we're taking your questions at 866-893-5722. And let's go, although Larry Mantle is away, Larry in Pasadena is calling in and has a question about socializing. Larry, what's your question?
Hi. Okay. So I am an old guy. I'm 69. I just got my second shot. So my buddy, who is 67, he just got his first shot. And so we hang out together about once a week, roughly. And we do it outdoors, and we wear masks and, you know, drive with the windows down and everything. But I just realized, well, hey, we both have shots now. Can we let our guards down with each other? Can we put our masks off?
And maybe, you know, sit like closer than 6 feet away and, you know, kind of have a more normal conversation, Larry. That's a great question. Hang on 1 second. And Professor Choi, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question, Larry. And one of the most common that I get for people getting the vaccine. So a couple of things. So first, I think it's important to know the timeline about how the vaccines confer immunity once you get them. When you get the first injection, it takes, you know, depending on which one you get, anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks for you to get to about 50% protection from that first vaccine. Once you get the second dose, which is 3 or 4 weeks later, depending on which one you're getting, it takes about an additional week after the second dose for you to get to that full 95% protection that we know the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines offer. So if you, and I will just say that full kind of from first dose to having immunity is about a month, about 28 days. So if you are somewhere within that 28 days, it's important to know that you're not fully protected at that point, and there is still risk of potentially contracting COVID. These vaccines are extremely effective, but they're not perfect. And so I think it's just important to be aware of the time frame and when we know that we've reached maximum protection. So, you know, at the point where you do both have the vaccine and you both have kind of gotten past that 28 days, is it okay to socialize with others? You know, I think that there's a lot of evidence coming out that these vaccines are extremely safe and effective, and they work very well to prevent spread of COVID. That's kind of been one of the big questions that we have. Even though we know they protect you, we haven't known until pretty recently whether or not you can still spread COVID. And it's looking like they are very effective at preventing spread of COVID too. Not perfect, but very effective. So I think that if you're both vaccinated and, you know, as long as you can continue taking steps to reduce risk, you know, things like being outside, continuing to wear a mask, we do have a lot more data, and I think it's okay to be confident that the vaccines work pretty well. At this time, though, the CDC and others are still advising that people take steps to reduce risk with things like, you know, spending time outside or wearing a mask and following public health guidance, because the vaccines are not perfect, and there is still quite a lot of COVID spreading around in the community. And once we get to that point of herd immunity will be when, you know, we really can let our guard down quite a lot more and socialize in a more normal way.
Thank you, Larry, in Pasadena for that question. Anne, also in Pasadena, asking about data on reopening schools and whether we know about kids getting COVID and passing COVID when schools have reopened. I know that many districts around the country have at least had the hybrid model or in some areas fully reopened. And Professor Choi, what can you tell Anne about what we know so far from the data about these kids in these schools?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a fantastic question. So we do have pretty good models now for how to reopen schools safely and really dramatically reduce spread of COVID. In schools, you know, where there is masking, hand washing, spacing between desks, opening windows, lots of measures that people are taking, as well as, you know, regular testing and contact tracing for all school personnel and kids. We've seen that school opening can work really well and really be quite safe in terms of spread of COVID. We're, of course, not quite there yet here in LA. We've had until very recently really, really high rates of COVID and are just now at the point where we're thinking about reopening schools. But I think we can learn a lot from other places that have done this successfully about how we can reopen our schools and make sure that staff as well as kids feel safe going to school and know that they're not going to be at undue risk for contracting COVID while they're learning.
Professor Choi, thanks very much, because I think so many parents are wondering about that and school administrators, and it is such a delicate and difficult decision. How about anxiety for kids who may be looking at, okay, the schools are reopened now and parents, and I'm going to go back to class and see people and do all these things that maybe I've been avoiding all year. and that's causing a lot of anxiety. What can you tell us about how that kind of transition can be mitigated?
Yeah, absolutely. So kids, I think, you know, when we think about sort of the mental health impact of this pandemic, it's something that we haven't talked about probably as much as we should. We certainly know that there are a lot of kids out there that are dealing with isolation and stress. There also are a lot of kids that have dealt with grief and loss during the pandemic, losing family members, grandparents, other loved ones to COVID. And the piece you mentioned, Libby, about anxiety is a really big one as well. Fear and anxiety, you know, when we talk about the pandemic and kids are seeing on the news and hearing about this virus and risk of death and risk of being sick and risk of dying or seeing family members in the hospital, all of those things can be really magnified in the mind of a child and can often become really disproportionate in terms of the anxiety it can lead to. So for kids who are experiencing anxiety about going back to school and might be afraid of contracting COVID or spreading COVID or anything related to the pandemic, I think it's really important for parents to have honest conversations with their kids about what reality looks like, what it looks like to wear a mask, wash their hands, and steps their kids can take to protect themselves. I also think it's important for kids who might be experiencing a lot of anxiety to engage mental health support. It can really go a long ways for kids to talk to a therapist who specializes in these issues and help them overcome anxieties they might be experiencing. Medical anxiety is common among kids, and it's something that there is help out there for if kids are anxious to the point where it's impeding their ability and willingness to go back to school.
Mm. Kristen Choi, professor of nursing and public health at UCLA, also a registered nurse practicing at Gateways Hospital based in Echo Park. We had an interesting question come in. Let's see, Keaton from Larchmont asks, do reactions people have from the COVID-19 vaccine tell us anything about how they would have reacted to just getting COVID?
That's a great question. You know, the reactions to COVID are so variable. It's difficult to say if having a strong reaction to the vaccine means you would have had a strong reaction to COVID. It's actually maybe a bit opposite of what you'd expect. I mentioned earlier that people who are younger tend to have stronger reactions to the vaccines in terms of side effects. We also know that for people who are younger, they are more likely to have asymptomatic or mild cases of COVID. So it's a bit difficult to link those two in terms of how COVID would have manifested because it just is so heterogeneous and unpredictable. We see it looking a whole lot of different ways. The good news is, though, for people who do have that strong reaction to the vaccine, in sort of a counterintuitive way, you know, it's a good thing. It's a signal that your body is learning to fight the virus and mounting that immune response that we want. So if you do have the side effects, you can take it as a good signal that you're developing the antibodies that we want to protect you from COVID.
But again, if people don't have side effects, that doesn't necessarily mean anything about their immune response. Am I right on that?
Absolutely. Again, people's bodies are all really different, and we all react differently, and not having side effects does not mean that the vaccine is not working.
Hmm. Michael from Burbank asks, do you think that as the COVID virus evolves, that we're going to have to leapfrog like we do with the flu vaccine every year and just create yearly booster shots?
Yeah, that's very possible. Booster shots are definitely being talked about as something that we may need in the future, especially as we're seeing these new variants of the coronavirus emerging around the world. The good news is that it's seeming like, especially with the mRNA technology, we're going to have very good capacity to quickly develop boosters and adapt to the variant. So that's possible, and it kind of remains to be seen what COVID looks like going forward, especially seasonally when you know these things tend to get worse in the winter months.
I'm just going to go ahead and ask because we have about a minute left in the hour and we've gotten to the listener questions. I was reading about this San Diego Zoo administering the COVID vaccine to orangutans and bonobos, great apes. And they're the first animals that a zoo or, you know, any researchers have administered the vaccine to. What is the information we should know about animals and COVID and, you know, is this situation of an ape getting a vaccine much different than the idea of like your family pet needing one?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the first thing I would tell people is that these animal vaccines, they are not the same as the human vaccines. No humans are missing out on a vaccine because they're being given to these animals. These are vaccines that were developed specifically for animals and cannot be used in humans. There have been isolated cases of animals having COVID throughout the pandemic, but for the most part, it does not seem like our pets, our dogs and cats at home are at risk for COVID. Giving the vaccines to the gorillas, I think there is definitely some concern that, you know, rare animals might be at risk for COVID, but for the most part, it doesn't look like it's a big risk to our household pets.
Makes sense. Professor Kristen Choi, professor of nursing and public health at UCLA, also a registered nurse. You've been wonderful. Thank you so much for being here to answer our listener questions and my questions about the apes at the zoo. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.